Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
headlines, dozens more civilians fall victim to Israel's relentless air and artillery strikes in Gaza as the regime's genocide rages on across the besieged territory. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees slams Israel's total blockade of Gaza, saying the regime is weaponizing aid and using it as a bargaining chip. And the Yemeni army carries out new anti-U.S. operations, shooting down another MQ-9 drone and targeting two American aircraft carriers in nearby waters. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, more Palestinian civilians are slaughtered in Gaza as the Israeli military presses ahead with its air and artillery strikes against the blockaded territory. In one of the latest strikes, at least four people were killed and several others injured in Israeli shelling of Palestinian homes in Al Tufa neighborhood east of Gaza City. Israeli forces carried out a deadly shelling on residential buildings in Khan Yunis. Also in Khan Yunis, a drone strike targeted tents of displaced people, killing and injuring several Palestinians there. Earlier on Wednesday, Israeli warplane struck a school housing displaced Palestinians in Al-Mawasi refugee camp in southern Gaza, leaving nearly a dozen dead and several injured. A number of children have been among the victims of Israeli attacks across Gaza. The death toll from the Israeli onslaught on Gaza since October 2023 has surpassed 51,260. Nearly 117,000 others have been injured. Ahmad Al-Najjar is joining us now from Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza with more updates from the Gaza Strip as the Israeli genocidal massacre continues all across Gaza as we speak. Ahmad, what do you have to share with us?
Well, Bardi, unfortunately, after more than 35 days since the resumption of the second round of Israeli genocide on the Gaza Strip, more civilians and more children and more families are being burnt and wiped out by the Israeli occupation, starting with the recent attacks that were mainly focusing on the northern cities and towns and parts of the Gaza Strip, where at least 10 Palestinians, at least 14 Palestinians, have been massacred by Israel's recent attack just over the past 12 hours. The most appalling massacre of those just took place within the Yaffa school. That is a school that has been made into shelter to harbor the dozens of families who have been displaced and lost their homes multiple times due to the continued aggression that has been focusing on the eastern neighborhoods of Gaza City. We're talking about At-Tufah neighborhood and Al-Shaja'iyya that for almost 30 days now have been just subjected to continued evacuation orders almost every other week by the Israeli occupation for the families to just leave under the constant bombings and under the ongoing artillery shelling that forced the families to leave their already devastated neighborhoods and stay in whatever sheltering they could find. Dozens of families of hundreds of Palestinians stayed in this particular school, the Yaffa school, only to be targeted last night by the Israeli warplanes and drones. We're talking about tents that were filling the yard of that school and were caught in the flames, and the people inside them engulfed in the flames. A very horrific massacre where at least 10 people have been confirmed killed and extracted by the different rescue teams. The aftermath of children, of people, families just turned to blackened remains. And also within the Gaza City as well, within the At-Tufah neighborhood, another residential building was struck by the Israeli warplanes, killing four Palestinians massacred in this attack, and many others have been wounded, and many as well are still under the rubble. The civil defense members announced that the attacks that are taking place within northern Gaza, the recent attacks are just too overwhelming for their capacity, and they are operating without the needed equipment, without the needed operations. Had their own bulldozers and vehicles, the remaining vehicles within northern Gaza have been struck just yesterday by the Israeli occupation, destroying nine of them that has been allowed to them during the ceasefire from the Karm Abu Salim crossing to just help them remove the rubble and extract those killed. But now, with more massacres and attacks carried by the occupation, they stand helpless as they are out of all the needed supplies and needed tool to just be able to extract those killed by the Israeli occupation. But also within northern Gaza, at least two more people have been confirmed killed within previous attacks by the Israeli occupation that targeted the different neighborhoods within the Jabalia town, where the occupation all over northern Gaza have been escalating the attacks to force more families to leave northern Gaza and come here to the southern parts of Gaza Strip, where the occupation propagates it as a safe humanitarian zone, only to have more families and more people massacred inside the very displacement camp inside the so-called safe zone.
Thanks a lot, Ahmed Al-Najjar, joining us from Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. Well, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has strongly slammed Israel's collective punishment policy in Gaza and weaponization of humanitarian aid. UNRWA Chief Philip Lazzarini said 50 days since Israel imposed a total blockade on Gaza, man-made and deliberate hunger is spreading and worsening. He accused Israel of using humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip and a weapon of war, saying that humanitarian organizations have aid ready to enter Gaza. UNRWA Chief added that Israel's collective punishment policy is affecting 2 million people, mostly women and children, depriving them of medicine and health care. Lazzarini stressed that to improve this situation, the blockade must be lifted, supplies must be allowed in immediately, and the ceasefire must be resumed. People in London have held a new pro-Palestine protest, this time gathering near the Prime Minister's office on Downing Street. Critical of the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza, pro-Palestine activists highlighted the British government's role in backing Israel's bloody campaign. Protesters called on the government to help end Israel's war on Palestinian civilians by stopping its military support for the regime. Some of the participants talked to our correspondent. Let's take a listen.
There is just no words to describe what's going on. The killing, the destroying of the land, the children being burnt alive, the hospitals being destroyed, healthcare workers being killed. And I think we need to speak up, because what's going on in Gaza at the moment is a genocide, and it's a genocide that is going on with the support of all the Western governments that are not lifting a finger. We need to stop arming Israel, because if we stop arming Israel, it will stop.
You know, his official title is Keir Starmer, but we all know him as Sir Kid Starver because of his complicity. It goes further, really. It's his encouragement of these war crimes. We don't want to live with blood on our hands. You know, we don't want to live at the expense of Gazans being starved in their homeland.
They obviously know about it. They're complicit in it. Like, the government's full of Zionists. Like, the government is controlled by Zionists, so they're not going to stop it.
We know that they're shipping F-35 parts to Israel. They're doing surveillance flights for Israel. So this is direct involvement.
I can't believe what we watch, and I cannot believe at least 20,000 children, men and women, and we leave out the men, and they are digging with their bare hands. It is absolutely despicable.
Israeli forces have launched another raid in the occupied West Bank, abducting nearly 20 Palestinians in the village of Kobar, north of Ramallah. Occupation troops, accompanied by two bulldozers, also stormed an eastern suburb of the city of Tul Karm. Let's now cross over to our correspondent, Nahal Ahmed, who's joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank to get the latest on the Israeli aggressions there. Nahal, what do you have to share with us from today's Israeli crimes?
Yes, well, the Israeli crimes does not stop over here. So we have day-to-day or hour-to-hour assaults and aggression to be reporting upon. Let me start by reporting to what happened over here in Ramallah, as it is still an ongoing event in the area of Kobar to the northern east of Ramallah. Since the hours of the night, the IOF has raided Kobar West, raided Kobar with large amount of soldiers and large amount of military vehicles, and have called it until now a closed military zone, closed the entrances and the exits of Kobar, and started a wide range arrest campaign among the Palestinians, freed prisoners and many other figures inside Kobar. Until now, we are talking about almost 40 Palestinians from inside Kobar have been arrested and then held inside one of the homes of Kobar that is being treated as a military outpost or a field interrogation for the Palestinians, and which is the home of the Palestinian freed prisoner who has been freed in the last batch of the Israeli hostage deal between Israel and the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, Nail al-Barghouti, which is one of the most recognizable figures inside Kobar. This is not the first attack upon Kobar, and Kobar is a very well-known name in the area of Ramallah, where Palestinians face atrocities over there. But of course, alongside with the Israeli aggression comes great determination that we have seen and documented from Kobar, and of course from nearby villages. Not only in Kobar the raid was best, but also over here in Ramallah, in the area of Al Isal and in the area of Al Masayef, throughout the night, the IOF has raided these neighborhoods and attacked many Palestinian homes in the hours of the night. And this came along with firing tear gas bombs and rubber covered bullets inside those neighborhoods. And in addition to that, not only let's go towards occupied Al-Quds, where the IOF has started a new demolishing campaign in the area of Al-Jib to the north and northwest of occupied Al-Quds. We have been reporting and documenting about a demolishing campaign. It is largely alarming, the rate of demolishing and the intensity of the demolishing campaign that are being implemented inside the West Bank is very alarming. Everywhere there is a demolishing campaign. In the last 24 hours, more than 30 Palestinian homes, buildings, and agricultural units have been destroyed. And this is actually quite important, because Palestinians have built those buildings or these agricultural units under extremely large and difficult and intense circumstances and situations, as no permits are allowed over here, especially since the beginning of the genocidal war.
All right, thanks a lot. Now, Mohammed joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Elsewhere, Yemen has fired another ballistic missile toward the occupied Palestinian territories, triggering sirens across the northern part of the occupied lands. According to Israeli media, air raid sirens were heard in the northern regions of Akka, Haifa, Accra, Kiryat Nahariya, and surrounding areas. They said for the first time warnings were issued in the north of the occupied territories due to missiles coming from Yemen. Reports indicate that the Yemeni missile targeted the Ramat David air base near Haifa. Local sources reported multiple explosions in the northern areas, proving failure of the Israeli air defenses in intercepting the missile. The regime's civil defense teams and several settlers were injured while heading to shelters. Yemen has been regularly hitting Israeli and American targets in the region in a show of support for Palestinians in Gaza. Earlier, the Yemeni army said it had shot down another U.S. unmanned aircraft over its territory.
Our air defense shot down a hostile American MQ-9 Reaper drone while it was carrying out hostile missions in the airspace of Hejaz Governorate. The drone was shot down with a locally manufactured surface-to-air missile. This is the seventh drone of its type that our air defenses have shot down this April, and the 22nd during the promised victory and holy jihad in support of Gaza.
Saadi said the Yemeni army also carried out two maritime operations targeting U.S. aircraft carriers Harry S. Truman and Carl Vinson, along with their accompanying warships in the Red and Arabian Seas. The operations against American vessels were conducted using a combination of cruise missiles and drones. Saadi reiterated that Yemen's operations will not cease until the Israeli aggression against Gaza ends and its siege is lifted. He emphasized that Yemen's military capabilities have grown stronger in recent weeks. The spokesman noted that Yemen has benefited from all developments and succeeded in affecting the enemy's actions and thwarting many of its attacks and assaults. Iran's foreign minister has held talks with China's vice premier in Beijing, where they discussed a wide range of issues, including progress in indirect U.S.-Iran negotiations and reviewed strategic cooperation between Tehran and Beijing. Abbas Araghchi briefed Ding Zhuxiang on the status of Tehran's indirect talks with Washington. He reiterated Iran's commitment to diplomacy despite past difficulties. Both sides also highlighted the long-standing friendly relations between Tehran and Beijing, with a focus on speeding up implementation of the 25-year cooperation agreement. Araghchi outlined Tehran's stance on key regional and international issues, including the continued Israeli genocide of Palestinians and the U.S. aggression against Yemen. Araghchi also conveyed a message from Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian to his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. Vice Premier Ding, for his part, expressed satisfaction with expanding Iran-China relations, describing it as a strategic partnership based on mutual trust and shared interests.
Iran, Russia, and China, three countries long opposed to Western hegemony, the trio are now getting closer in their cooperation amid the world's rapidly shifting geopolitical landscape. Once wielded to reinforce their hegemonic power, the economic and political pressure from the United States and its allies now appears to have backfired, further pushing Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing closer together. The three nations are now unified in their defiance of unilateral Western sanctions as they explore shared interest in forging deeper economic, political, and strategic ties. As a significant development, Tehran and Moscow have recently inked a 20-year partnership agreement, solidifying long-term cooperation between the two Caspian Sea neighbors. The deal, hailed as a breakthrough by Russian President Vladimir Putin, aims to boost long-term collaboration across various sectors, including defense, trade, and energy. It also establishes a comprehensive framework for enhanced coordination on both regional and global issues, moving relations between the two nations to a strategic level. China's role in this strengthening alliance is just as significant. The trio has ramped up its trilateral meetings with a key summit held in Beijing in mid-March, where they discussed a range of regional and international issues. Beyond bilateral and trilateral ties, the country's cooperation further extends to multinational institutions. These platforms provide Tehran with economic alternatives outside the Western-led financial system and offers diplomatic leverage and security partnerships with Asia's major players. Iran's growing integration into these non-Western alliances has become particularly evident as it engages in indirect nuclear talks with the U.S. Amid the talks, China and Russia have been actively advising Tehran as a strategic partner. Tehran says it'll continue to consult the two as the negotiations evolve. The growing alliance among the trio signals a significant shift in global power dynamics. Analysts suggest this cooperation is not a temporary response to immediate issues, but rather a strategic realignment aimed at reshaping the global balance of power in the long run.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir.
The supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
The people of Gaza, whose voices are often silenced regarding their future, are left with little more than fragments of history. Just as they once gathered the fragments of a monument to defy those who sought to crush their spirit, they will continue to cling to their memories, stories, and land. They will resist and rebuild, not just their homes, but their very identity. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the second part. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Zionist regime claims they are for security. In reality, however, they push Palestinians farther from their land. Israeli citizens will not see Palestinians from their windows, but Palestinians will be forced to look at their own lands, including agricultural areas that they cannot access and control. Will families once living in these areas be pushed into high-rise buildings, confined to smaller controlled spaces? If so, this is not reconstruction, it's confinement. The United States regime and the child killer regime of Israel have rejected the Arab reconstruction plan. This raises questions. How much influence can Arab countries have when their views go against U.S. and Israeli interest? Where does this leave Palestinians, the people of Gaza? Why isn't the voice of Palestinian leaders enough? Is there any Palestinian leader they can trust? Despite public endorsements, the Arab League's reconstruction plan remains just that, a plan. No concrete steps have been taken to implement it, leaving the Arab world's response confined to rhetoric and written proposals, even after the war resumed. The Zionist regime is rapidly changing Gaza's reality, occupying and reconfiguring it as it sees fit, indifferent to words and condemnations. In Gaza Diaries, Muin Besiso, one of the most prominent poets of the Palestinian resistance, recounts a little-known chapter of Gaza's history, the Israeli demolition of a statue for the unknown soldier following the Israeli occupation in 1967. Erected in 1956 under Egyptian administration, the soldier's statue stood as a tribute to Egyptian and Palestinian soldiers who had fought against Israeli occupation. The towering statue of a soldier, weapon in hand, symbolized defiance and resistance. Yet, when Israeli regime forces occupied Gaza in 1967, they destroyed the monument's pedestal. The next morning, the Israeli regime governor arrived to inspect the site, only to find it covered in flowers, as though nothing had happened. In a quiet act of defiance, the people of Gaza had gathered the fragments of the monument and hidden them in their homes. The Israeli regime military, disturbed by this, conducted an unusual search, not for weapons, but for the missing pieces of a stone. Besiso suggests that the governor's frustration reflects a deeper colonial impulse to erase not just the physical monuments, but the spirit of the people. He echoes an old doctrine of conquest. If you want to kill a people, you must first kill the symbols they love, erase everything that ties them spiritually to their struggle, kill their history, their memory, their icons, and then, only then, go after them. The real fear wasn't the rebuilding of the monument,
but the resurrection of its significance in Palestinian consciousness. If even one stone remained, it could serve as a foundation for something greater, not in physical form, but in meaning. For the first time, an army found itself at war with fragments of a stone. The soldiers weren't searching for fighters. They were searching for memory itself. In Gaza, remembering is a way of rebuilding what was destroyed. Despite its destruction, the sight of the unknown soldier remains embedded in Gaza's historical consciousness. To this day, the area where the monument once stood is called the Unknown Soldier Square. When Palestinian sovereignty was partially restored under the PA, the monument was rebuilt, only to be struck by an Israeli regime missile in 2005. In 2023, during the Zionist regime's latest invasion, the entire area was destroyed once again. The people of Gaza, whose voices are often silenced regarding their future, are left with little more than fragments of history. Just as they once gathered the fragments of a monument to defy those who sought to crush their spirit, they will continue to cling to their memories, stories, and land. They will resist and rebuild, not just their homes, but their very identity. Yet the power wielded against them is immense and harsh. And with each wave of complicity and silence, it grows harder to find a flicker of hope. Gaza is an ancient land with over 5,000 years of history. Through countless wars, it has endured and rebuilt itself time and again. Its resistance is etched into its stones, streets, and people. More than a place, Gaza is a symbol of an enduring struggle, one that Palestinians fear might soon be erased from both memory and history. Gaza is the known soldier, but even the soldier, it seems, is becoming invisible.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Black and white.
Como una manera.
As a way to confront discontent or prevent popular discontent from expressing itself in revolutions and social change.
En revoluciones y en cambios sociales. En los años 1961.
In 1961, John Kennedy, then President of the United States, decided to implement a humanitarian policy.
De carácter humanitario, es decir, entregar.
That is to provide some handouts and support to the poorest sectors of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Thus, he created the United States Agency for International Development.
Para el desarrollo internacional. Hasta ahí parecía una buena.
Up to that point, it seemed like a good measure. But the fine print bore, of course, what has already been said, a political intention.
pero no solamente se queda en la intención, sino que pasa a intervenir.
But it doesn't just remain an intention. It begins to openly intervene in the internal affairs of every country. And along with a few kilos of milk, some flour, some oil, it bought up countries' media outlets, funded journalists, influenced parliamentary judicial systems, and also influenced regime and government changes depending on the United States' interests. USAID currently has 60 bases worldwide, but it interferes in 130 countries. This is not a trivial matter. All countries, particularly in Latin America, have suffered from this. This was a response, of course, to the influence of the former Soviet Union at the time, on the one hand, and then, here in Latin America, the Cuban Revolution. And that's why Kennedy, John Kennedy, along with USAID, of course, hand in hand initiated the Alliance for Progress, which lasted for a while to prevent rural areas from turning into a vast guerrilla stronghold throughout Latin America, given the dire living conditions faced by farmers and residents in our countries. In other words, USAID has never truly been dedicated to addressing hunger or the severe shortages faced by our communities. No, USAID has always served to put the interests of the United States at the center. Of course, it sounds strange that Donald Trump and his administration today are saying that it's an unnecessary agency. But what is Donald Trump thinking? Is it changing its name, reorienting its policy?
Cambiarle el nombre, reorientar su política, o es que ya Estados Unidos en la actual etapa.
Or has the United States at this current stage decided to use only the stick and not the carrot? Perhaps so, because the truth is that it seems that the U.S. regime no longer needs to mask its interventionism and its interference with humanitarian aid. In fact, he needs everyone to listen to him and to be afraid of his measures. His military, economic, aggressive, and occupation measures. The economic sanctions that are now being imposed even more severely on the Islamic Republic of Iran. The threats to the Islamic Republic of Iran, the invasion or bombing of Yemen. In short, the United States is showing its true nature, a fierce one. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. En el plano internacional hemos sido golpeados con una noticia. La administración actual de la Casa Blanca con Donald Trump.
On the international stage, we have been struck by a significant piece of news. The current administration under Donald Trump has labeled the actions of USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, as shameful, citing its harsh interventions in numerous countries. This raises the question, what's really going on? Will American imperialism cease its interference in the internal affairs of other nations and stop its aggressive tactics as it has in the past? Are we at a time when sanity returns and imperialism changes its nature? All right, to explore this topic, we need to understand the roots and the reasons behind what's really happening. Today, we're joined from France by a very special guest. A Colombian who relocated to France in the 1990s due to the violence in his home country. I'm referring to Hernando Calvo Ospina, a sociologist and author of several published books. Hernando, how are you? Welcome.
Hernando, ¿cómo estás? Bienvenido.
I'm very well, thank you.
Hernando,
Hernando, what's really happening in the United States today? With all your experience dealing with organizations like USAID, what makes sense to you? What happened? Has the nature of the United States changed?
¿Qué pasó? ¿Cambió de naturaleza a Estados Unidos?
Mira, honestamente, yo no sé qué le pasó a este gobierno de Trump.
Honestly, I'm not sure what happened with the Trump administration in this moment of truth, where they finally acknowledged what many of us already knew. Some were aware of it, but it suited them better to remain silent about the implications of USAID. I'm uncertain about the origins of this situation. Perhaps they're considering creating an organization, whether under the same name or a different one. That could be even worse, because we can't expect anything better from Trump. What I do recognize is that he effectively opened the eyes of those who thought USAID was a benevolent entity, revealing that the United States isn't as virtuous as some might have believed, or perhaps they never were.
O es que nunca han sido santos.
Así es. Ahora.
That's right. Now it seems that Donald Trump is moving towards a more overt form of interventionism, no longer masking it with claims of humanitarian aid, which comes across as quite harsh. On the international stage, he is demanding things like territory, suggesting that Greenland should become American land, insisting that Canada should join the United States, and claiming that the Gulf of Mexico should no longer belong to Mexico, along with wanting control over the Panama Canal. These demands are quite aggressive towards various countries. Are we at the time of the stick and not the carrot?
Estamos en el momento del garrote y no de la zanahoria.
Yo creo que ahora realmente con Trump uno no sabe. Yo pienso.
I believe that with Trump it's hard to predict what will happen. He seems to think the world operates like a real estate market, where he made his billions. It's one thing to tell someone to leave their home, but it's entirely different to treat countries like Canada or Greenland as properties to be bought or sold. They are not just houses that can be traded. Moreover, there's the issue of his inconsistency. We've seen it from January until now. He makes one statement and then changes it the next day. Remember, he claimed he could end the war in Ukraine in 3 days, and those 3 days have stretched on indefinitely. The real concern with him and his advisor, whom I refer to as the cleanup guy of the state, is what they might decide to do next. Additionally, he claimed that there would be no wars, yet he has already initiated a war in Yemen. Who knows where else he might stir up trouble? So what's really going on? As for the situation with USAID, I honestly don't know. But again, I don't have the answers, but with the United States, it's always wise to keep both eyes open and stay alert.
Y dormir con ellos abiertos.
Y además con un sentido de despertar rápido, ¿eh?
We also need a quick awakening in Latin America. Let's talk about USAID. It would be great to learn a bit about its history. What led to its formation and when did it happen? What were its main objectives? I understand you have knowledge of specific instances of significant interference in Latin America, particularly in countries like Cuba. Has USAID ever been involved in such actions?
Sure, let me simplify that for the viewers. The story of USAID is quite straightforward. It has its roots in the well-known Marshall Plan, which the United States implemented after World War II to support Europe. Many people credit the Marshall Plan with helping Europe to recover and thrive again. However, it also left Europe in debt to the United States, a situation that persists to this day. Then in 1961, we saw the emergence of another significant initiative led by the charming President Kennedy, who was very attractive and handsome, sporting his stylish jacket.
Let's pause for a moment and then we'll return right away to continue our discussion.
Thank you.
de vuelta acá con Hernando Calvo.
We're back with Hernando Calvo. You were sharing with us the origins and the historical context in which the well-known USAID was established. You were also touching on the Kennedy administration and possibly the Alliance for Progress. Please go ahead.
Por favor, adelante.
Sí, te decía que este hombre con...
Yes, I was telling you about this charismatic man, very handsome, who not only introduced us to the Alliance for Progress, but also brought us USAID. Let me share a little story. I was one of the first children in Latin America to receive, so to speak, the benefits of USAID. I was 5 years old and in school back in 1966, and I remember that in my humble neighborhood, they delivered bags of powdered milk and flour for making bread. I can still recall the taste of that milk. It was labeled as a gift from the government of the United States of America. This aid never reached the wealthy neighborhoods. It was always directed to the poorer areas. Why? Because USAID, similar to the Alliance for Progress, though the latter lasted only a short time, was established to counterattack the impact of the Cuban Revolution, which succeeded in 1959. USAID was created with the goal of reaching the poorest neighborhoods, as President Kennedy believed it was better to address the revolutionary sentiments in urban areas rather than having to pursue them in the mountains. Thus, USAID was initially founded for this purpose in 1961. I also want to share that the first country where President Kennedy launched the Alliance for Progress and USAID was Colombia, specifically in Bogota in December 1961. He later expanded it tremendously. One of the two countries where the Alliance for Progress gained significant traction was Argentina, along with Chile and Peru. The reason for this could be linked to the presence of a strong social movement, or perhaps the U.S. security systems recognized the potential for robust social movements in these three countries, prompting their focus there. Primarily, I emphasize this attention was directed towards the more impoverished sectors. Eventually, the focus shifted towards Brazil. Interestingly, in these countries, various organizations began to emerge, including NGOs. However, prior to their arrival, religious organizations such as evangelical churches, Jehovah's Witnesses, Baptists, and Pentecostals had already established a presence. It's very easy for people who have followed this to realize when these churches arrived there. Additionally, the well-known tradition, family and property movement, came behind USAID, with USAID money, to tell us how good the American system was.
Lo bueno que era el sistema estadounidense.
Tiene un manto, una mano, digamos, humanitaria.
It has a cloak, a hand, let's say, of humanitarianism. Some claim it's the humanitarian hand of the CIA. However, its influence has been significant, particularly in the media landscape. There are impressive figures regarding the media outlets that USAID has either purchased or funded through NGOs and foundations. The number of journalists it has supported up to this day is noteworthy. Some of them are currently trying to find ways to stay connected and secure income. This creates a rather complex situation. For instance, what specific examples can you share from your work that illustrate how this manifested in brutality rather than just the humanitarian facade?
No en el manto que tenía.
Mira, tú vas a decir lo más concreto.
Look, you just mentioned it. The most specific thing in their history was funding organizations known as non-governmental entities, supporting even leftist union and media outlets. There's a very clear example of this. It took place in Chile before the overthrow of President Calderón.
No, incluso fue en Chile fue durante.
No, even in Chile, it happened earlier during a time when the dictatorship was facing challenges. When imperialism decided that it needed to come to an end, it began funding certain so-called Democrats, those who were quite compliant with the United States. There was also a specific form of progressivism that aimed to ensure that the transition would not disrupt U.S. interests, but rather legitimize them. The actions taken with NGOs in Chile and foreign foundations were quite striking.
Listen, I want to share something with you. In the case of Chile, it wasn't just a significant economic experiment for the United States. It also served as a major experiment for the European Union, as you mentioned, even before the overthrow of President Salvador Allende, during the preparations for his ousting and afterwards. While we have focused on the assassination, the coup, and the subsequent Pinochet dictatorship, which are undeniably important, we often overlook the crucial role that USAID and other American institutions played. They not only experimented in Chile, but also applied those lessons to other Latin American countries, particularly Venezuela under President Chavez, and later to other nations through what became known as the Color Revolutions. This included funding NGOs, journalists, and media outlets. Chile was a vast laboratory, not just for neoliberal economic policies. We haven't thoroughly explored this aspect, particularly regarding Chile's experience before and during the coup against Salvador Allende and the subsequent period under Pinochet. This dramatic chapter, where USAID invested billions of dollars, has had lasting effects that continue to resonate today. We've forgotten to investigate this, and I think it's very important.
Se nos ha olvidado investigarlo, y creo que es muy importante.
Así es. Ahora, en los tiempos actuales.
In today's world, it's evident that the opposition to Nicolas Maduro's government, including figures like Guaido and Gonzalez, has received substantial financial support. Reports suggest that even Donald Trump is inquiring about the whereabouts of that money. Additionally, it's mentioned that Zelensky has sustained himself with humanitarian aid through USAID, and they too are being asked for accountability. How does this relationship with their full-time employees make sense?
Empleados no a tiempo completo.
Yo creo que en el caso de Venezuela también está en el caso de Cuba.
I believe that in the case of Venezuela, as well as Cuba and Nicaragua, particularly in Latin America, vast sums of money have been invested to overthrow these governments. Over $1 billion was spent in Cuba to try to dismantle the Cuban Revolution, yet it remains intact. In Venezuela, I can't specify the exact amount, but it was also over $1 billion, and a similar figure applies to Nicaragua. This raises the question, where did all that money go? Because these three countries and their revolutions are still standing strong. They also did a lot to overthrow Evo Morales. Evo Morales has completed his term. Now, let's take a look at the current situation within Bolivia, examining the direction things are heading and the influences at play. It's understandable to question the roles of figures like Guaido in Venezuela, as well as various human rights organizations and journalists. I've discussed similar topics regarding Chile in other programs, and it raises an important question. Where is that money? Where is that funding? If it was intended to destabilize these nations and it succeeded in some cases, like Cuba, then what happened to all the money that USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy and Alliance for Progress, along with other organizations, invested to overthrow the Cuban Revolutionary Government? Why hasn't it worked? Where did it go? Who benefited from that money? It was Guaido and his group in Venezuela. Where has it gone? You mentioned Zelensky, yes, but as I was saying earlier, what about all the money that went to some eastern countries? Where is that money? This brings us back to our earlier discussion about how it's important for Trump to clarify where all the money the U.S. government invested has gone. Now, I don't know if we also look at where that money went, because now there are many organizations in many countries around the world that are supporting feminism, sexual freedom, and a host of other issues.
Con la libertad sexual, con una cantidad de cosas.
Estamos ya llegando al final. Estamos cortando.
We're nearing the end now. We're wrapping things up. And yes, you're right. We need to pay close attention to a type of progressivism that can be quite beneficial to the United States at certain times. Unfortunately, we have reached the conclusion. I express my deep gratitude for all your time, dedication, and willingness. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. See you next time.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Habib Zata, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about an interesting topic. Pets, is it ethical to keep them according to the religion of Islam? Sayyid Mohsen, let's start with you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we talk about the pets, yes, there are some animals who are allowed, or, you know, Islam talks about them, to keep them as a pet, for example. Cow, goat, you know, sometimes they have said in some of the narrations, obviously, when we look at the Islamic perspective, either we look at the Quran or the narrations, we see that there are certain pets which were, you know, animals which were at the home as a pet. And but the main thing is, you know, when you want to have an animal, you must look after the rights of the animals as well. For example, in the chapter An'am, and verse number 38, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَمَا مِن دَابَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا طَائِرٍ يُطِيرُ بِجَنَاحَيْهِ إِلَّا أُمَمٌ أَمْثَالَكُمْ. You know, we have the animals and the birds that fly, you know, with the wings. They are not except something like you. They are the communities like you.
Okay.
You know, مَا فَرَّطْنَا فِي الْكِتَابِ مِنْ شَيْءٍ. And we have not neglected anything in the book. ثُمَّ إِلَىٰ رَبِّهِمْ يُحْشَرُونَ. And after that, they all will be gathered towards their Lord. So this verse also tells us that there are the rights of the animals, as we need to look after the rights of the, you know, being a human being of each other. We need to look after their rights as well. And
Islam respects the rights of the animals, okay?
Islam respects the rights of every single, you know, creature. Thing that exists.
Okay, yes.
You know, plants, even, you know, it is said in some of the narrations that cutting off a tree is just like killing a person. So, you know, we have these kinds of narrations as well. So Islam pays attention to every single, you know, thing that exists, because these all are the creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah has created all of them.
Yes.
And they all have, you know, their own status. And they are for each other. But on top of that, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made human beings as ashraful makhluqat, the superior of all of the others, so these all are made for the mankind so that they can reach to perfection. Okay.
But not living with them, Habib, isn't it?
First of all, just to add off, and then we'll come to your answer. We have, for example, prohibited animals to keep as pets. One of them is dogs.
Yes.
There's a saying that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi told Gabriel, the angel, why aren't you coming inside the house? He says, I think that there's a dog in the house.
Oh.
So he goes to the inside the room of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He sees that there's a puppy in the house. So he takes the puppy out.
Okay.
And
also pigs, for example.
Pigs, because they're dirty, yes, and whatnot. But there's no prohibition, you know, keeping one. But you cannot own one.
Yes.
There's a difference between the two, right? And there are different narrations that state, for example, that the Imam alayhim salam had chicken. They had kinds of pigeons, al-rawa'ib, and they cursed the killers of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And for example, that keep a hen in your house because it wakes you up for Fajr prayers, for example.
Yes.
Keep your chicken in the house because it keeps away devils and demons from your children, for example. And the Imam alayhi salam had pigeons. I'm 100% about that.
Okay.
There's a saying that Imam Baqir alayhi salam had them.
Yes.
He gifted them to some of his companions and whatnot.
Yes.
Cows and cattle and stuff like that, normal for Arabs at the time to have, you know, as pets and, you know, to use and take. We even have this saying that a man, a companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, had a lamb. He raised it until it became big.
Yes.
And then he sacrificed it and ate its meat. He went to the Imam. He said that, before I sacrificed it, it looked me in the eyes, and I looked it in the eyes, and I felt some kind of mercy. But yet, I still continued to do my work. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam told him, I wish that you didn't have, you wouldn't have slaughtered it.
Oh.
And of course, horses, donkeys,
yes,
and stuff like that were also available.
The goats and the sheep.
Yeah.
Yes.
And of course, we see a lot of emphasis on how to act with horses,
mm-hmm,
and camels. Because
yes,
they usually, these were the mainstream,
yes, yes,
pets. They were usually used the most.
Yes.
And the Imam Ali Musallam, the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, do not hit your animal. Treat it well. Give it water.
Yes.
Do not put heavy things on it.
Or cutting out the tails. Yes.
Exactly.
They did not do that.
And for example, he saw a camel that had a lot of stuff on it,
yes,
and its owner was not available.
Yes.
It was tied.
Yes.
The Prophet said, "Where is this person? This
mm-hmm
person is going to